Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
Well, I actually agree with Marx that I don't think that belief in God is grounded in a reality. I think that it is things that we've, stories that we've told ourselves, fables that we've told ourselves to make the world more palatable, to overcome our fears of death once we realize that we're all bound to die. And I don't see it corresponding to anything real about the world. And the more we know about evolution and the way we have evolved, the more we know about the kind of wasteful amount of suffering that evolution brings, the harder it is for me to believe that the world was created by a divine being who is also benevolent to the suffering creatures that he or she has created.
Workers of the world unite. You have nothing to lose but your chains. The famous rallying cry from Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels from the Communist Manifesto, published in 1848. Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. How relevant is Karl Marx today? Does he still matter? And how have Marx's ideas and insights inspired generations of thinkers, artists, writers and politicians? Well, on tonight's show, we're going to tackle those questions with Australian moral philosopher, teacher and writer Peter Singer, whose latest book, Marx: A Very Short Introduction, has just been published by Oxford University Press, where Peter argues Das Kapital is a work of art, of philosophical reflection and of social polemic, all in one, and it has the merits and defects of all three of these forms of writing. It is a painting of capitalism, not a photograph. Peter goes on to state, Marx was devoted to the cause of human freedom. So, what was Marx's theory of capitalism? What did he get right and what did he get wrong?
I'm Peter Singer. I'm a professor of philosophy. I'm probably best known for my book Animal Liberation, written back in the 1970s. I've also written a lot about effective altruism. And I've written introductory books on Hegel, Marx, and utilitarianism.
Really well done on your short history of Marx. Peter, I have to say it was a very accessible and very stimulating read. You throw out so many interesting questions in relation to Marx thinking, how we should understand him, and also his relevance, I think, for today's world. And it made for a great read. I might throw you a big wide open question to kick things off, and sure we can take it from there. Should everyone read Marx, do you think, Peter?
Well, there's a lot of good things out there to read, and I'm not really going to say that everybody has to spend a lot of time struggling with Marx, but I do think that an educated person today should know something about Marx, so they could pick up the Communist Manifesto, for example, a fairly short and easy-to-read work. I wouldn't think that everybody ought to read Capital. That's too long and difficult, and you can just read the little summary in my book and save yourself a lot of time.
Is it fair to say, Peter, that Marx was one of the most ambitious thinkers of his time? And what I mean by that is he set out to change the world.
Marx did want to change the world, certainly, and he certainly was ambitious. And he claimed that he had understood the laws of human development, the laws of by which societies change, and that as a result of understanding those laws, he could predict that capitalism would be overthrown and that it would be replaced by a communist society. So certainly there's a lot of claims there, and you could describe them as bold and ambitious, undoubtedly.
It struck me as I was progressing through the book that in one way Marx was a better philosopher than an economist.
Yes, I don't really think Marx was an economist. I think Marx offered a critique of economics from the outside. His critique essentially was that economics takes certain laws as if they are always prevailing, as if they are somehow natural or given, whereas Marx, coming from a Hegelian background, sees things as progressing, as historically determined, and therefore as liable to change. So I think that is, in a way, a philosophical vision that Marx is bringing to economics rather than getting into the detailed work of economics. I don't think his I don't think you really would want to rate him as a top-ranking economist, so I think he is better thought of as a philosopher.
He really had a vision for how we should live, and certainly within that, it was all about freedom, wasn't it?
Yes, and that surprises people, of course, who see communism, particularly the thing of communism in the Soviet Union and its satellites, as something that Marx was promoting, and that was certainly the antithesis of freedom. But Marx thought that communism would bring freedom and had a very different vision of communism. And again, following Hegel, he thought that human history was moving in the direction of the liberation of human beings from all kinds of constraints and restrictions. And among them was the liberation from the alienation of labor, which he thought was an important limit on our freedom, the fact that we are working for others, we're not working for ourselves, and we're working to enrich others who then, they're of course the capitalists, who then use the profits they make to further enslave us within the capitalist system.
Yeah, I was very interested in what you wrote about Hegel and his influence on Marx. You write somewhere that the idea that, you know, Marx believed that the idea of history, that it was proceeding towards a necessary goal. And it got me thinking that, you know, can we actually look at history? Do you think it's fair to look at history like that? And is that not maybe a bit reductive?
Well, I certainly don't think that we should assume that history is moving towards a goal. I think in a way that's a pre-Darwinian view of the way things happen, because once we understand Darwinian evolution, we don't see it as goal-directed, but rather we see it as things evolving because they're better suited to the circumstances and not with any particular purpose in mind. But Marx, although he was aware of Darwin, didn't want to apply Darwin to human history. He thought that that was a different realm. And so I think that there is, in a way, he's accepted assumptions that certainly go back to Hegel, but you could say go back long before Hegel. You could say they go back to religious visions of the world as having some purpose and heading towards some outcome, like in religious terms, you know, the apocalypse and the redemption of human beings. I think that that was a mistake, in a way. That's an unscientific way to look at history.
Well, do you believe in human progress, Peter?
Oh, I think one can believe in human progress, and I think one can think that in the long run there are likely to be gains. Martin Luther King famously said the arc of history bends towards justice. I think one can argue that. I've actually written a book called The Expanding Circle, which talks about the way in which we are expanding the circle of morality, including more beings within it. You know, we used to start with a tribal morality, then maybe a national morality. Then we have a universal human morality, but I believe we need to include non-human animals within the sphere of morality as well. So I think you can see certain progress, perhaps because of our capacities for reasoning and thinking about these issues. But to say that it's sort of predetermined that there will be a revolution which overthrows capitalism and where workers come together cooperatively and own the means of production and use them for the benefit of all, I think that's going too far. I don't think one can really read that into history.
I suppose in a lot of ways we're all a little impatient with our history, that we feel that it's not moving in the right direction. And within that, all the inequalities that have been a centre narrative through our history. I'm just wondering, as a moral philosopher, you've written a lot of books. What is your own philosophy of history?
Well, I think that history is not determined, that we make our history. I mean, Marx would have perhaps agreed with that, though we make it under certain circumstances and constraints. But I don't think I would claim to be able to see the future. I'm hopeful that we're moving in progressive directions, as I've said, and that we'll overcome the problems that we face. But I can't be confident of that. If you take, for example, the problem of climate change, this is a huge problem that will require cooperative action from essentially all human beings, and we don't have a world government, so that means the nations that rule them. And if we don't get that right, then we could be in for a disastrous period in which large parts of the earth become uninhabitable. And I can't have any real confidence that we're going to solve that problem, or for that matter, other problems that pose a risk perhaps to the very survival of our species.
But when we look at market systems throughout the world, when you look at the state of globalisation and how it's impacting on people all across the world, it's very easy to kind of slip into this sense of despondency and misery.
I think that despondency and misery comes only if you really follow the newspaper headlines, which tend to report the bad things that happen. It's obviously it's news if a war breaks out somewhere, as in Syria, or if there's terrible disasters that kill thousands of people. It's not news that every day lives are being saved by progress in providing better health care to people, or providing sanitation to people in extreme poverty, providing some basic health care, developing economies. And in fact, if you look at it, there are fewer people, as a percentage anyway, a smaller percentage of the world's population living in extreme poverty now than in Marx's time, or probably in any time since humans evolved. We're down to around 10% of the world in extreme poverty, which is really pretty good by earlier standards.
Well, Marx was all about asking questions and critiquing the world and the relationships around them, social, cultural, financial, and so on. So I'm just wondering, what questions do you think he'd have of how we're doing today?
Marx raises questions about, are we in control of where we're going, or are we dominated by the economic system that we have? And some of the concerns about globalization that you just mentioned would certainly be ones that he would have raised today. That is, are we really using our economic powers for the good of all, or are they enriching the few? And if the interests of those few perhaps favor continuing to burn fossil fuels, even though in the long run that's going to be disastrous for everyone, are we going to be able to stop that? Those are questions that I think Marx might ask if he were around today. But I have to say, of course, if he were around today, he'd be very surprised that capitalism is surviving and indeed you could say thriving, and that the world has not become substantially communist as he had predicted it would.
What would you think he would make of our obsession with property?
Well, obviously this our concern with our own property, with private property, is contrary to what he would have expected to have happened, because he thought a revolution was going to break out quite soon. In fact, in various times during his own lifetime, when there was an economic crisis, he thought it was about to occur. And so he would be surprised that we still have such substantial amounts of private property, that there are so many privately owned factories and means of production. And probably if he was aware of the direction that China has gone, for example, he would be surprised at that too, because China is clearly, despite being officially ruled by a communist party, has clearly gone in a capitalist direction in terms of its economy, reintroducing much more private property than there was under Mao Zedong. So I think Marx wouldn't quite know what to make of this, and would have trouble readjusting his theories to the world he sees if he were to somehow come back to life now in this 200th year after his birth.
You argue that Marx saw his role as raising the revolutionary consciousness of the workers and preparing for the revolution that would occur when conditions were ripe. Do you think there could ever be conditions when, you could actually visibly overthrow all systems? Do you think that could ever actually happen? Like, I know we've had pockets of it, but like a complete global transformation, if you will.
Well, you see, Marx thought that capitalism would be overthrown in the most advanced capitalist economies, because he thought the more capitalism advanced, the fewer capitalists there would be. A small number would control, and the remaining small capitalists or craftspeople would be forced to sell their labor and therefore would join the working class. And he thought that this was an unstable situation. So if the communist revolution had occurred in the most developed countries, that is, in his time, that might be the United Kingdom, it might be Germany, it might be France. Well, if that had happened, then those countries, of course, were the dominant military forces as well, and communism would then have been established globally. But, of course, that didn't happen. The communist revolutions broke out in countries that were less advanced, like Russia, or in fact that were completely agrarian, perhaps, like Cuba. So That's why when the communist revolutions did occur, they did not achieve global communism as Marx expected. And I don't see that as happening. I can't see that capitalism is going to be overthrown in the foreseeable future. I can't see any path towards achieving that. So I think what we need to do is to work within capitalism to improve it incrementally, to reform it, to make it better for people at the bottom, but not really to try and scheme and plan for its revolutionary overthrow. That just seems to me a futile task.
And do you think you can meaningfully improve capitalism? Do you think that's possible as a system?
Oh, I do. In fact, I think that it is. That is happening. I mentioned I've written about the effective altruism movement, which is a movement that is trying to persuade more people to act altruistically to make the world better and to do it in a highly effective way. And I think there's no doubt that we are helping people in extreme poverty, who, of course, are not the people in developed countries. The really poor in the world are the people in developing countries. But I think that we are making a difference. We are, as I said, there are fewer people in extreme poverty as measured by the World Bank, or if you want to measure the number of children who die before their fifth birthday, which is also an indication of extreme poverty, that number has fallen quite dramatically. It was 20 million in the 1990s. Now it's below 6 million. So considering that the world's population has increased, that's a very promising sign. I think that's the kind of thing we need to do. We need to focus on helping people who are very poor, people who are oppressed, people who have troubles that capitalism is not helping. But I think with enough people working altruistically to help others, it really can make a difference and at least ameliorate the worst effects of capitalism.
And what about the gigs economy, Peter, and some of the inequalities within the system and how the system is evolving? Like, how do you think you can change that, and what would you advise?
And Marx would, of course, have expected that any new technology that was productive would be used under capitalism, and that this would put some workers out of work. And he thought that that was a necessary part of capitalism, actually, to keep this kind of reserve army of the unemployed, to keep wages down. It's interesting that it hasn't actually kept wages down. Marx thought that the working wage would remain always fairly close to the subsistence level, and that certainly hasn't happened in the developed countries. I can't predict what is going to happen with the gig economy, or for that matter with automation, which I think is going to displace a large number of jobs over the next decade or two. What I hope is that governments will realize that they have to provide a basic minimum wage for everybody in society, a universal basic income, and that has to be adequate to give people a minimally decent standard of living, because otherwise I think we are going to get into a lot of poverty again with people who are unemployed and are not adequately supported.
Could you have ever conceived the idea of intelligent robots taking over the world? You know what I mean? Like, you started out in the workplace over 40 years ago, and now the biggest threat, I suppose you may not say to critical intelligent thought, but kind of everyday jobs is intelligent robots. I know it is a reality and will become an increasing reality in the next 20 to 30 years.
Yes. I think that is something that I guess people have anticipated, and it's a continuation of trends that went on before. But exactly how we're going to handle it is the question. I think, you know, I think it's not surprising that we get more and more automation and more robots. But what is the real question is, what will we do with this increased productivity? Because it is a way of being more productive, and it's in some sense it's a good thing that humans don't have to perform boring, repetitive tasks, and that they can be replaced by automation and by robots. But what happens to the productivity? What happens to the extra profits that are made from this? Are they returned to everybody, and in particular to the workers who are displaced, or are they going in to increase inequality within the society? That's the real question we have to ask.
So a new form of surplus value, is that what you're saying there, is it?
Actually, I mean, it's curious because Marx thought that you could only get surplus value out of living labour, out of workers, in other words. And one interpretation, at least, of what Marx says about surplus value is that if you completely automate the factory and you have no workers running it, then the capitalist won't be able to make a profit. Now, that doesn't seem to be right to me. I think capitalists will still make profits. So it's not exactly, well, certainly not an extension of surplus value in Marx's term. It's something rather different.
Have you ever asked yourself what the world would look like if Marx never came into being? Like, I presume somebody else would have dreamt it up. Do you think we were always going to get this critiques coming from somewhere? It just happened to be Marx.
I think we were always going to get the realization that our ideas and our politics and our religion is not completely autonomous. It doesn't just progress from its own inner logic, but it's affected by the economic structure of the society we live in, and that this is an influence that we need to be more aware of. So that seems to me to be one of Marx's valid insights, that I think if Marx hadn't had it, someone else would have had it. In fact, you could argue that Hegel had at least a part of that himself. So, yes, that we would have. But in terms of the theory of economic development of capitalism, class struggle, revolutionary overthrow of capitalism and its substitution by communism, I'm not sure that we would have got that. I think that that is perhaps unique to Marx's thought. And it's interesting to speculate on how human history would have been different if we hadn't had that vision and it hadn't been followed and implemented, of course, by people like Lenin in particular in the Soviet Union, and how history would have been different then.
Yeah, it's hard to think that we would not be having conversations on class struggle in a lot of different ways. You write something very interesting in the book. You say Marx's contribution to our self-understanding is another reason for ranking him high amongst philosophers. I thought that was very interesting because, you know, a lot of people would think about Marx and they think class struggle, alienation, workers' identity and all of that stuff. But they possibly don't really give the same significance to the inner journey Marx was asking us to make with ourselves and how we're living on the world and the conversations we're having on the world on what we're doing with our lives.
Yes, that's true. But I mean, for Marx, this was not so much focused on the individual as on the classes and the necessity for the working class to understand their situation and therefore to develop the revolutionary consciousness that would overthrow capitalism. Now, as we've been saying, I don't think that that is a feasible outcome. So I think that what Marx is telling us in terms of our self-understanding is that we are part of a system, we are influenced by that, and collectively we are not really controlling our own destiny. And we need to do more in that way to work together with others in order to control our own destiny. As I was saying, for example, in terms of climate change, that this has to be joint action. We have to work together to solve it. Unfortunately, of course, just in the last few years, what seemed to be previously a promising movement of more integration of global institutions through the European Union and possibly through the United Nations has rather been going in the opposite direction, of course, with the Brexit referendum and with the election of people like Donald Trump and the populist governments in Poland and Hungary and Turkey. So I hope that this is only temporary and that eventually the progress towards greater working together and self-understanding in the sense of recognizing that we're all in this together resumes. But when that will happen exactly, I'm not capable of saying.
I'm just wondering, Peter, as a moral philosopher, how do you explain why so many people seem to avoid or try and kind of just dodge out of thinking on the harsh, cruel realities of climate change? And, you know, it's not like people aren't doing much travel. If you know, we can see the damaging impacts climate change is having here in Ireland. But if you get on a plane anywhere in the world, you go anywhere in South or Central America or all across Africa, it becomes so visible so instantly. So I'm just wondering, how and why do you think people are just avoiding it? Is it that they just can't take it? They just don't want to look into the future? They just can't handle it? What is it?
Well, certainly part of it is that people don't want to look far into the future. They're more concerned with the short-term, the present and the short-term future than they are with the long-range future. That's an unfortunate characteristic of many, perhaps most, human beings. It's also the fact that I think we have evolved certain moral responses to harming people in ways that have always existed. So, for example, if you see somebody beating somebody up, particularly beating up someone who's defenseless, we have a kind of instinctive revulsion to that. We have a negative revulsion to it because there's very visible harm, and we evolved in societies over millennia where people did that, and the societies work better when we stop that happening. But if you think about emitting carbon dioxide, we have not known that that is harmful until the last few decades, not nearly enough time to evolve any kind of response to it. And so we don't see it as something that's really wrong. We don't see wasteful consumption of fossil fuels as something that evokes in us a kind of a negative, hostile reaction in the way that seeing someone beat up another person would. So I think this is part of the reason why it's such a difficult problem for us to grapple with. And the other factor, of course, is that we, as I said, we do need everybody to work in it. And each of us as individuals can say, well, I'd like to go on this holiday that involves flying somewhere, and everyone else is doing it, so why shouldn't I do it? It's not going to make very much difference. All of those things, I think, work together to make it a really difficult problem for us to resolve.
And arguably, society is becoming increasingly more individualistic. So in order to solve issues in relation to climate change, you need a collective response, intergovernmental, international institutions, the works. So when, you know, when people recognise the garden over in Africa is not really their backyard, well, does it really matter? Like, how do you, what would be your response to that?
Yes, I think perhaps we're becoming more individualistic, but certainly we're becoming, once again, more nationalistic, which, as I said, is a really worrying trend that we see with Brexit and with Trump. And I do think that we need to try and resist that, and we need to have strong movements of people to say we're all in this together, and we should be just as concerned about people in Africa as we are about people at home. And, in fact, since their needs are likely to be greater, their situation is likely to be more desperate as a result of climate change, we should arguably be more concerned. But what it's going to take to achieve that, I don't really know. It's going to take a lot of people working together to make sure that this has, you know, sinks into people and that people will vote not just in their narrow short-term interests, but in the broader interests of the world as a whole, and if you like, in the interests of their children and grandchildren.
If it doesn't sound too reductive, I'm just wondering, we've talked about global economies and the environment there. I'm just wondering, what has Marxism done for the world? Because, you know, a lot of people wouldn't automatically think of Marx, Karl Marx, when it comes to the environment or climate change. They will think of China, they will think of regimes, communist regimes and so on. And they would blame Karl Marx for a lot that went wrong with the world. But Marx wasn't, you know, he didn't advocate for authoritarianism and these regimental regimes. But unfortunately, it is a byproduct. So do you think he didn't think it through?
I think that he had a mistaken view of human nature. And that's really the reason why he was not worried about communist regimes becoming authoritarian. His view of human nature essentially was that there isn't such a thing as a biologically given or evolved human nature. As I said earlier, he didn't think that Darwinian evolution really applied to human beings. And so he thought that the nature of human beings depends at any time on the economic and social system in which they're living. And that if you change that, if you abolish capitalism and you abolish private property, you will also abolish egoism. And you will instead have people working cooperatively for the common good of all, with cooperatively owned means of production. Now, of course, it's true that, you know, society and the economic system has some effects on our human nature. I'm not going to deny that. But what we saw when, in the Soviet Union, for example, private property was abolished, wasn't that people stopped thinking about their own interests. Rather, they tried to increase their power, and in particular those in the Communist Party, had power struggles and killed their opponents in order to consolidate their power. And that's also a form of egoism. And Marx did not think that this was going to happen. Actually, there's some notes that he exchanged or wrote on a work by Bakunin, the anarchist who he saw as a rival at the time, in which Bakunin was basically saying that these workers' councils will cease to be operating in the interests of workers and will instead operate in the interests of the people on them, who will then become bureaucrats, basically. And Marx said, no, that's not going to happen. But if you look at the communist countries, it seems that Bakunin there was the one who got it right.
Would you describe that as a naive instinct, or maybe he was just a bit too optimistic, Marx? What do you think?
It may be that he was influenced by optimism, by hoping that things would go well. It's certainly not naive, because it's based, in his view, in his grounding in Hegel again, that these things are historically given, that they're not natural or innate. So he had a whole theory to support this view, and he did consider it. But I think he got it wrong. Maybe he was not didn't give sufficient weight to thinking about evolution and the way evolution has favored those who look after their own interests and the interests of their offspring, because, of course, the others just don't leave descendants behind at all, and didn't realize that those factors were going to persist even if you abolished private property.
But I can only imagine that if you brought Marx back today, how some of his ideas have been misconstrued. Like what's come out as Marxist regimes in some countries and so on has very much misunderstood some of his key principles. But it's all in, you know, under the flag of Marxism. So, but you can't control that, I suppose.
Well, certainly once Marx is dead, he can't control the use that people make of his ideas. Even in his lifetime, actually, he had some correspondence, not so much about authoritarianism, but more about rigid interpretations and understandings of the materialist theory of history, which led him to say in a letter, all I know is that I'm not a Marxist. So even in his own lifetime, he could see that people were misusing his name. But I think if he had lived long enough to 1917, which of course would have made him 99 years old, not very likely, and been able to comment on seeing the development of the Soviet Union into a dictatorship, then I'm sure he would have said this was not Marxism as he understood it. In fact, he thought that under communism, the state would become less powerful. He actually said the state would wither away, that it would have some administrative functions, but it would no longer need coercive functions. But of course, what we saw under Lenin and Stalin, and also under Mao, is that the state became much more authoritarian, much more coercive. And this was certainly not something that Marx himself anticipated or would have tolerated for a moment.
Peter, one thing I've always been interested in is Marx's religious makeup and his ideas on belief and ideas in relation to how we understand ourselves in the world in relation to whether there is a God or what that God can do within the world. He certainly was no great believer, sure he wasn't?
No, he wasn't a religious believer at all. He took from Ludwig Feuerbach the idea that belief in God is a kind of projection of all that is best in human beings into another sphere. And Feuerbach saw this as a form of alienation. We take all that is best and most noble and most powerful about us, we imply that there's a divine being who has it, and then by contrast, we live in this veil of tears, we're limited and humble, and yet these powers really, Feuerbach and Marx thought, are actually human powers, and if only we could act cooperatively together, we would have all of those powers and have that nobility. So Marx thought that religion was this kind of escapism. In his famous line, he said, it's the opium of the people. It's something that comes about because of the conditions that we find ourselves in the real world, the fact that we cannot run the world as we want to run it. We are dominated by the circumstances in which we find ourselves and the economic conditions in which we live. And so we escape from that, as you might escape by smoking opium, we escape from that into dreams of a better world through religion. But Marx thought that that was really just, a fictional escape, and one that probably was really harmful to changing the real world, because, you know, it's the idea of you'll get pie in the sky when you die, so you don't have to worry too much about making sure you have pie for dinner tonight.
And within that fictional escape, what is your own view in terms of pies in the sky, etc.? What do you think happens, and what do you think it's all about?
Well, I actually agree with Marx that I don't think that belief in God is grounded in a reality. I think that it is stories that we've told ourselves, fables that we've told ourselves, to make the world more palatable, to overcome our fears of death once we realize that we're all bound to die. And I don't see it corresponding to anything real about the world. And the more we know about evolution and the way we have evolved, the more we know about the kind of wasteful amount of suffering that evolution brings, the harder it is for me to believe that the world was created by a divine being who is also benevolent to the suffering creatures that he or she has created.
It's interesting, though. Marx looked at the world in relation to, you know, ideas in relation to class struggle, and looked at it and all brought it down to the economic relationships within society. Others could look at the world that it's all about religious strife and struggle and religious wars. I suppose it all depends on where your values are, is it?
Well, Marx would have said, no, it depends on what's really driving what. It's a causal question. Are these religious wars being fought often for economic reasons, or are they being fought purely for religious reasons? My view would be that it's sometimes one and sometimes the other, and that we can't say that economics always determines everything else. But certainly, we also shouldn't say that the religious beliefs that we have are entirely independent of the kinds of society that we live in and the economic circumstances of that society.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, I'm talking with Australian moral philosopher, teacher and writer Peter Singer, whose latest book, Marx: A Very Short Introduction, has just been published by Oxford University Press, where Peter argues, we can now see the construction of a free and equal society is a far more difficult task than Marx realised. I asked Peter about some of the personal tragedies that Marx faced in his life and his impressive emotional and mental resilience to keep on going.
Yes, he certainly had some difficult times, and he was, after all, really a refugee. You know, he was born in what's now Germany, and spent time in France and in Belgium, but was after the collapse of the revolutions of 1848 and the reinstatement of more repressive governments, he really had to flee. Communists were being arrested, and he found refuge in England and was able to work there. But, of course, he was a foreigner in England and had to establish himself and make connections. And he did have the personal tragedies, as you mentioned. He was fortunate, perhaps, in finding in Friedrich Engels a benefactor, a factory owner, or the son of a factory owner, but he then himself ran a factory in Manchester, who was nevertheless a communist and thought that Marx was the greatest genius ever to have lived, and supported him financially and certainly helped him in that respect.
Yeah, I found reading about their relationship in the book very interesting. And you quote Engels in the book. I think it was at his at Karl Marx's funeral. And he said something on the lines of, Marx was before all else a revolutionist. His real mission in life was to contribute in one way or another to overthrow of capitalist society and of the state institutions which it had brought into being, to contribute to the liberation of the modern proletariat. I love the word proletariat, but I'm just wondering, do you think that's a fair assessment of his life?
Well, I think there's two aspects of Marx's life. There is the intellectual aspect and the development of the materialist theory of history, and all that that entailed. And then there is the contributions to the revolutionary struggle. And for Marx, those two things were not really separate. They went together. The discovery and propagation of the materialist theory of history was a way of seeing what would happen and why it was necessary for workers to develop the kind of consciousness that would lead them to overthrow capitalism. But then he worked himself with workers, working class organizations on the continent and in England to foster that kind of consciousness and to help to advance that struggle to overthrow capitalism. So yes, that was definitely an important part of Marx's life, that he was a revolutionist as well as being a great thinker and somebody who analyzed his times and produced theories about why it was as it was and what was going to happen.
It's amazing to think that here we have Frederick Engels, who was obviously from a very wealthy family and could afford to support and sponsor Karl Marx's thinking and ideas. But then we have these two men who meet. And, you know, the way history goes, this unusual moment that they get to meet, synergy in history, if you will, and they find each other and they work and collaborate together over a series of years, encouraging and supporting each other and carrying each other in different ways. But it got me thinking maybe that, you know, without Frederick Engels, Karl Marx could maybe have not pulled it off.
Well, that's possible because he certainly, there were periods when he really relied on Engels for financial support. Later on, he, through his wife, had some inheritances and could have managed better. But if he hadn't had that support from Engels, I suppose he would have had to go out and get a job, like most people do. And he would have not been able to devote all that time that he did to reading in the British Museum and writing. And who knows? I guess he would have produced something, but he certainly would not have produced as much as he did. So, yes, I agree. We owe a great deal to Engels for having enabled Marx to work in that way. Owe a great deal. Of course, some people might think it would have been better if Marx had not written all of that, but it certainly did make a difference and in that way changed the course of history.
In all the seriousness of the topic, I laughed my head off when I got to your further reading section, Peter, because you note, and I wasn't aware of it, that Amazon have copies of the Communist Manifesto available for free on Kindle. It made me laugh so much, and I imagine if we could bring Karl Marx back, that would give him the ultimate laugh, wouldn't it?
I hope so. I hope you would see the sense of humour in that. But in one sense, you could say it might be very deflating because Marx, in fact, the Communist Manifesto begins with this idea that a spectre is haunting Europe, and this the spectre, the fear of communism. And the fact that one of the, perhaps, the wealthiest capitalists in the world, I don't know if Jeff Bezos is now past Bill Gates and others, but he's certainly up there in the top two or three, doesn't fear the spreading of the Communist Manifesto and is quite happy to give it away for free on through his company, suggests perhaps that it's lost its potency, that the Communist Manifesto is of historical interest rather than something that capitalists need see as a threat.
Well, you have to admire the humour in Jeff Bezos for doing it anyway.
I suppose so. I mean, I'm not sure, honestly, we don't know whether that decision was run across his desk or across his computer, because it may simply be that, along with a lot of other works that are no longer in copyright, Amazon decides to give them away on Kindle to encourage more people to buy Kindles. So it may be a capitalist decision, a profit-making decision in its own way.
Did you read Thomas Piketty's Capital in the 21st Century?
Yes, I'm familiar with
and
that
what did
book.
You make of it?
Well, it's interesting. And a lot of people did see it as in some way supporting Marx's views because it does talk about inequality, about the gap between rich and poor as one that is not going to close, that is widening. And people have seen that as giving support to Marxism. I think actually Piketty's view is quite different from Marx's view. And the reason it's different is that for Marx, the progress of capitalism was going to be self-destructive in that the working class were going to remain at or very close to the subsistence level, while the rich, the capitalists, were going to become wealthier but also going to become fewer. They were going to concentrate their wealth in the hands of few. Now, Piketty doesn't say that the working class are going to become worse off. In fact, he sees small increases in the standard of living of the working class over time due to technological progress. He sees some of that feeding back into the working class. It's true, of course, that he sees the wealthier groups as enriching themselves much more through this progress, and that's why the gap widens. But it's a widening gap in which even those at the bottom are becoming better off. And that's a crucial distinction with what Marx thought, because if people at the bottom are becoming better off, it's possible that they will not see this, therefore, as a system they need to overthrow. They'll say, okay, well, we're better off than we were and that previous generations were, so the system is benefiting us. Whereas in Marx's terms, that would not have happened, and so a revolutionary situation would have developed.
Well, whatever you think, whether Marx got it right or wrong, it is admirable to think that the courage he had in his ideas, the hope and the optimism, and that he was able to put those ideas out there and have the drive and the belief in himself and his ideas.
I entirely agree, and I think that's the way our ideas progress and philosophy progresses. We need to have people putting up bold hypotheses for others to consider and discuss and possibly refute if they're wrong, but that's how we learn. And of course, you know, both Marx and Hegel thought that we do progress that way. They have this idea of the history proceeding by a dialectic and of a thesis, and then its opposite, the antithesis, giving rise to a synthesis, and then that in turn gives rise to a new opposite, and he thought that was how history progresses, until we finally get to the stage of human liberation. And so for Marx, essentially the dialectic was going to stop when we got to communism. That was going to be the end of that kind of historical progress. Now, obviously that didn't happen, and I don't believe that it is going to stop. But this basic idea that we need people to put up bold ideas and then we need to assess them and take what's valid in them and reject the rest and move on, I think that's true, and I think that's something where we can see Marx as having had an important place in that understanding.
And of course, history is about that creative tension, that push and pull. So I can only imagine that maybe in 300 years' time, as progressive as we see ourselves now, and as how wonderfully fair we feel we all are with our wonderful international human rights law and our progressive democracies and all the rest, that we will be look back at us as that we were in a state of chaos, we didn't have a clue, and how could we have even thought to think that blah blah blah. So that's the way it's always going to be, people carrying on and carrying forward other people's ideas and making them better and better.
Yes, I think that's right. Of course, it's very hard for us to predict what people will think in 500 years time or 300 years time, but if there are still humans around and if we've solve some of our problems, then no doubt Marx's views will be a part of that story, a part of that progressive development of ideas, many of them mistaken, but nevertheless a kind of bumpy up and down path towards the better world that we can hope people will be living in 300 years.
Lastly, Peter, if we could click our fingers here and I'd say, Peter, tonight, 10 o'clock, I have a nice table for two booked for you and Karl Marx, a nice little French bistro, a decent bottle of wine, sit down, chat, man to man, what would you say to him? And what would you like to figure out that you haven't so far? What's still on your mind?
I would really like to know what he would say now if he understood that human nature does not change when we change the economic basis of society, or at least that it does not change as radically as he thought it would. Because that seems to me to be the key mistake that he made. And how would he apply his thought? How would he apply his great concern for the well-being of all, his concern for to end the suffering of humans, how would he respond to the idea that human nature is not so pliable as he thought, and what kind of arrangements would he therefore want to put in place rather than the ones which I suppose either you could say have been tried and failed or perhaps have never even really been tried because there was never a system that really worked in the way that Marx thought communism would work.
And that was Australian moral philosopher, teacher and writer Peter Singer. Karl Marx, A Very Short Introduction, is published by Oxford University Press and retails for in around €9 in paperback. Now, I have to say, for anyone interested in exploring the relevance of Marx's ideas today, well, this is a very good starting point. It's accessible, smart and brilliantly argued. Okay, well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. Okay, all that's left for me to do now is to say a big thank you to Simon Maguire, who helped out with this evening's programme, and the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been talking books. I'd like to end tonight's broadcast with the thought-provoking and memorable words of Karl Marx, whose 200th birthday we're celebrating this year. Necessity is blind until it becomes conscious. Freedom is a consciousness of necessity. Thought-provoking words indeed. Good night.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.